What's up? What would you do if you had to live with no running water? What are all the things you do in a day that require water? And how much water do you need to use for a day? If you had no running water at your home, where would you go to get water? Where would you take a shower? How would life be like if everyone else within miles where you are living are also without running water? What if you're living in a city? If you ever visited Cape Town, you'll see what this reality looks like, as this city is considered number one on the water countdown city list, followed by Miami, Tokyo, London, Mexico City, São Paulo, Moscow, Beijing. And there was even a time, believe it or not, in the United States where California and Arizona almost went to war with each other over their shared water supply. So nothing is as important as water these days. From countdown cities to military conflict over water, it's essential that you and your community secure your supply for generations to come. And there's no better book that teaches you how to empower yourself with the tools you need to secure your own water supply in an ecological manner. So please join me as we dissect the juicy details of Water Storage by Art Ludwig. Bom dia, buenos dias. Welcome to Eco Village Library. I'm your host, Christopher Kinney. And I'm here to summarize for you great works being produced within the world of sustainable development, resiliency, eco-village community living, you name it. And a little bit about myself, my background is in civil engineering, and most of my working and learning years have been primarily spent with small communities throughout the Americas, especially around water systems. And man, did I feel I ran into this book a little bit too late, because this was the book I was looking for several years ago, especially when I was in the situation of managing community water systems in Latin America and designing and building water storage into these systems. But I eventually came across this book, which really served as a great treasure box of knowledge. Such good knowledge that I feel it deserves some time to dissect it. So why should we store water, and what kind of situations call for it? Now imagine you have a seasonal job, per se, as a mover. More people tend to move during the summer when the weather is nice and everyone's moving around. You'll notice all kinds of jobs coming your way, making quite a bit of money, perhaps more than you know what to do with. Then the season slows down and you notice you have to better manage your finances so as to ensure that you still have enough for your expenses. Well, this concept is sort of like that of your water supply. You know, you may live in an area where half of the year you may get abundant rainfall and moisture, perhaps way more than you know what to do with. Then comes the other half of the year where it doesn't rain at all. Now, how can you best provision and store all that water during wet season so as to last you during the dry season? This is one reason why to think about storing water for your site. And actually, perhaps the most common reason to have water storage is to provide for peak demand that may actually sometimes exceed the amount of water you have coming in originally from its source. And you could have a stream run right through your property and have it feed your 10,000 gallon storage tank at, let's say, 1 gallon per minute. And to give you an idea of what 1 gallon per minute, or GPM, looks like, imagine the lowest pressurized sink or shower you've ever used and how little and slow the water came out. This is about a little more than 1 gallon per minute. But then all of a sudden, a hostile crowd of zombies shows up on your land and chases you with pitchforks. They catch you by surprise while you're at the tank. Then you realize, aha, this baby can blow out water like there's no tomorrow. You attach the fire hose that magically dropped down from the sky, hook it up just in time, and you blow away at the zombies, throwing them off their feet with a flow rate of 100 gallons per minute. This is an example of what water storage allows you to do with all the water coming in with a flow rate lower than that of a low pressure shower or sink, and allowing you to literally fight a fire with a high pressure fire hose. Now, another advantage for having stored water is to cover your water needs when unexpected drawbacks or disasters happen that cut off your connection from your water source. You know, when I was managing the water for a small community in the jungles of Panama, having a pair of water tanks saved their butts so many times, I can't tell you how many times, especially during the peaks of rain season when the floods literally destroyed our entire water line. And desperation of over, 100 people at the time were literally kept at bay solely because we had those water tanks to keep us going until we fixed whatever problem we had. And boy, we did get close to going through our last drop of water. Water storage can also improve the quality of your water as well. You know, there are many factors to consider here, but the longer that water stays still naturally, any sediment that normally harbors harmful bacteria sinks to the bottom, and whatever else lighter than water flows to the top. But there's a very interesting phenomenon that happens called attrition. You know, the book here says a well-designed container reduces pathogens. They die off faster than they multiply. Now, this is because human pathogens are designed to thrive in the human body, not a cold, nearly nutrient-free, dark water tank. The longer the water is stored and the less favorable the survival conditions, the more attrition occurs. But mind you, this is for well-designed systems that take in high-quality water without any organic matter. Because in the reverse situation, the longer or more stagnant the water, the worse it'll be with time. You know, the absolute worst you could do is to collect all the untreated water in a tank exposed to the full sun, leave it there to fester all summer, and then drink it afterwards. No. That's a big no-no. And we'll explain why, you know, with the reasonings later on. And another reason you may want to store your water would be for its thermal storage and freeze protection abilities. You know, having stored water nearby acts as a nice buffer to temperature changes. It just takes way more to freeze an entire tank or pond than it is to freeze water in a small pipe. Now, this works perfectly well in a solar greenhouse or even in your home, which can help keep it colder in the day and warmer at night. Also, my particular favorite use of stored water is to produce electricity, if you have enough elevation difference. So this is not always the case, but sometimes it could work out. And it worked out for me when I was in Panama. From the tanks we had, you know, we experimented with a micro hydro project with a used car alternator, and we were able to produce enough energy from the difference of elevation we had from the drainage or the overflow from the tanks. And that was about 30 feet, just enough to get it spinning and working, producing an energy that we were able to harvest in a battery. But this energy producing feature is more of an exception or a bonus, if you will, than the principal advantage of water storage. You know, there's so many other advantages of having water storage, of which the downsides are extremely variable and most could be prevented from good conscious design. Now, what I really like about this book in particular is that it emphasizes ecological design. So designing your water storage system in such a way which will have the least impact in terms of the embedded energy coming from the materials, the work, and so on. So everything taught here in the book ensures minimal overall negative impact on natural and social systems. The author says the easiest way to do this is to spend as little money and use as little water as possible. You know, I stayed with several isolated communities throughout El Salvador, where every time I took a shower, I had to use a small bucket of water behind a flimsy curtain that separated me from the rest of the family I was staying with. And this is how they lived their lives for as long as they remember. And this was new to me. And this is, you know, the extreme example or personal example of how little water one can literally use day by day. Now, we as humans, can literally get by every day with only about 10 gallons per person per day. In the industrialized world, however, each person's uses are on average about 100 gallons per day. So on the farms I worked at in Argentina, the same water used to clean dishes was kept in, you know, three separate buckets and used throughout the entire day. One bucket was to wash with soap, the other bucket to rinse, and the last one was to sanitize. So here are some quick bullet points to remember in the design process of your water storage system. Place your storage in the highest location possible so as to only utilize gravity and even maybe extract energy in the process, as we talked about. Mimic nature as much as possible. Utilize as much of the water as you possibly can before it eventually leaves your site. Design to extract benefit from other attributes of your water, such as nutrients, pressure, temperature, softness, etc. Add to your water only materials that biodegrade into plant nutrients or non-toxins like biodegradable cleaning products, for example. And these are only a few amongst many others. You know, Art Ludwig, the author, says that all design is the art of trade-off. And I think he hits it with a nail there. And try to avoid at all costs a narrow, myopic, tunnel-like vision view when designing your system. You know, don't get too attached to any philosophy or to only one specific goal. You know, keep a broad picture view. Now realize that you'll want to have water for different kinds of uses, which will require their own standards. Drinking water obviously demands the most stringent standards, so you'll treat this water differently. One neat example I've seen with this was at an eco-village I worked at in Colombia, which collected their rainwater in tanks from which they filled with big glass jars and laid them out in front of a reflective aluminum under the sun for about a day or two, depending on the cloud cover. And first of all, water from the rain usually comes with higher quality, provided your roof isn't made of any toxic materials. Then added sunlight cooks whatever bad pathogens or bacteria may remain in the water. And they also had, interestingly, nice words written on each jar, which they believed added to the improved water quality. You know, such as, like, one jar had love, one, you know, written on it, the other jar hope, the other jar courage. And this all originates from a very interesting study by Dr. I don't know his name at the tip of my tongue, from Japan, The Miracle of Water or The Life of Water. Google any combination of those words and you'll probably find what I'm talking about. It's very interesting. And I have to dive into that myself, actually. But luckily for drinking water, the storage filtration sizing requirements are minimal as compared to use for irrigation, livestock, dishwashing, bathing, laundry, toilet flushing, etc. You know, so the author says you'll make your life a whole lot easier by making a separate system with separate storage for drinking water. Now, rainwater from roofs are particularly useful for washing, laundry, and flushing salts from the soils because rainwater is extremely, what they say, soft, meaning that it has low concentrations of ions and calcium and magnesium. So this is also good to tie into your gray water system, or in other words, your household wash water, which, by the way, should never be stored in a tank for more than 24 hours. Ideally, this will go straight to the plants that thrive off of this kind of water. You know, I've been around stagnant gray water before, and let me tell you, it smells terrible, almost like that of black water, which is sewage or poopy water. Now, for design parameters and size in your water storage, the biggest thing to keep in mind is population. Think 25 years into the future, if you can. Any longer than that is just, frankly, too unpredictable. And remember, design for change. The book expands on this one and mentions to design for failure and expect every piece of the system to fail at least someday. You know, nothing in life lasts forever. So plan for this. How can these potential failures have the least effect on you? You know, one key, the author says, to good water system design is to focus less on the water. Now, let me explain. You got to design for the other stuff. This includes thinking about the materials that sink to the bottom, materials that float to the top, materials that dissolve into or out of the water, the air that is displaced by the water, that's got to go somewhere, and the water-seeking critters that crawl or fly into the system. You know, one time, the system I was managing was clogged up, and I could not figure out why and where the problem was. It took me quite a bit. So out of desperation, I just took the whole piping fittings apart from this tank, and boy, did I find a big old dead frog stuck right in the inlet of the tank. It was disgusting. It smelled horrible. So plan to eliminate these situations for yourself beforehand. And it's funny because Art Ludwig, the author, explained about his experiences finding dead rats in his water supply. You just do not want to come across that. So you got to think about protection from this ever happening. So I mentioned briefly already water quality being improved with water storage, but the reverse can also happen when poorly designed. Avoid rectangular shaped storage because it's highly inefficient structurally speaking, and also a bigger waste of materials. You know, it creates dead zones in the water, which creates pockets of lower quality water. You know, so the more oxygen that's uniformly mixed in, the better. There's so many other common storage problems that the book does an excellent job of laying out in a nice schematic. Like some other things to keep an eye out for are making sure to enclose the tank, keep it away from the sun if you can, put close attention into building the right foundation, and so on. Also, contrary to common beliefs about water treatment, the author highly discourages the use of chlorine to treat your water. And yes, it's highly effective at killing pathogens, perhaps the most effective. So much so that once you inject chlorine into the system, it continues to kill even through the piping network until the sink. Most industrial water systems are set in this way. But, and here's the big but, if there is any organic matter in the water at the same time as chlorine, what will happen is that these two will react together to form highly toxic cancer-causing byproducts called trihalomethanes, particularly causing bladder and colon cancer. So if you have to put in chlorine, oftentimes, ironically, mandated by law, then make sure you filter out suspended solids from the water first, and then use as little chlorine as possible. And also be aware of leaching as well. You know, every material that touches your water leaches into it some degree. So the big question is, what's the material? When you add heat into the mix, leaching of plastics in particular become more of an issue. So it's wise to keep any water-holding plastic away from the sun. Now let's talk about bacteria. Interestingly, the author mentions bacteria as a standalone, not at all a health issue. For example, you could use the same water bottle over and over again and even notice a weird smell after many times using it. But this is all right. It's nothing more than an aesthetics issue. The problem is never bacterial regrowth from clean water. The problem is unwashed hands introducing fecal matter, in particular, back into the water containers. So not washing your hands after going to the bathroom and somehow having that touch the water you're going to be drinking. And this is one of the biggest issues in the world today, mostly in non-industrialized countries. And if you really want to know how stored water is doing quality-wise, you can use a quick test via your senses by smelling or tasting it, or you can hold it to the light and see if you can easily look through it. When I was in El Salvador for a project that we were doing for wastewater improvements for the community, we had several plastic containers of water separated into what was contaminated for drinking, but okay for everything else, and then the other set for just drinking. And this was almost a decade ago when I was still learning how to understand Spanish. And so I took one of the containers to gulp down, and all the old ladies in the community looked at me as if I was nuts. They were screaming, no. And foolishly, I said back, no, no, it's all right, it's all right. And then I went up to go take my big gulp, and one of the old ladies grabbed the bottle and shook it in my face and said, mira, mira esto. And looking at it, did I realize that there were so many particles floating inside, which is referred to as turbidity. And turbidity doesn't always mean the water is bad, but it does mean there is a lot in there, and oftentimes means there's a higher probability that there is bad bacteria in there. And so she just saved me from giving myself the biggest dose of E. coli. And funny enough, the whole group I was with, we all got it right before heading back to the States. And boy, let me tell you, it was the worst experience of my life. You know, let's just say that half of us were really hurting up in the attic, and the other half of us was really hurting down in the basement, if you know what I mean. And I was one of the basement people, sitting between two girls on the trip that were really hurting in the attic. And man, I could get so graphic here. And let me tell you, it was traumatic. But maybe another time if you request the graphic details of the story. But for the purposes of this discussion, I'm just going to move on. And so the point of all of this is know what's in your water. There is no other better way to be sure what's in there than with a do-it-yourself lab test, testing for general and fecal coliforms. So now we've kind of brushed over the surface of water and water storage in general. Now let's go a little bit deeper. We'll start with all the different kinds of storage options. Again, it all starts with your situation and your goals. No, there's never a golden answer to anything. But let's say, you know, I have a piece of land in a warm Mediterranean climate. My goals are to grow all sorts of crops and trees. So one major element important to me then would be irrigation. So my goal for water storage will be to store water in the soil, which also would be the least expensive option. So it'll be like soaking up a sponge. And to keep it from leaving via evaporation, I would want to place mulch over any exposed soil to keep the water contained. Now, the author mentions his own experience with this technique, saying that on his orchard, water stored in soil shortens his irrigation season by 2 to 3 weeks on each end, which considerably reduces the tank size needed. You know, a couple of weeks doesn't sound so much to you, but when you're talking about water and water demand, it makes an entire difference. Every single quantity counts. Now, once the soil gets more than it needs, like a super saturated sponge that begins to drip, the water will then leak down towards your ultimate savings account or shared savings account amongst the community, which is the groundwater supply. And since it's quite difficult to imagine the flow and behavior of groundwater, a fun experiment you could always do is put together a sandbox like what you might have had as a kid, and then soak it with a hose of water. Ideally, your sandbox edges will be of glass. And I say this because I've observed this through glass. I was very spoiled when I was studying engineering, and we were able to observe all kinds of water phenomena through columns of glass and seeing how it moved within the soil particles. But for the purposes of this do-it-yourself, easy, quick-to-do experiment, have your sandbox edges impermeable to contain the water that you will then sprinkle over. And once you do that, observe how the water may run over the surface before it seeps down and saturates the sand underneath. It will flow slowly under the surface around the particles until it hits the impermeable floor, at which point will raise back up and create puddles and ponds and lakes. And eventually you will begin to see where the overhead water likes to flow, as it creates little streams that grow bigger into rivers as the groundwater moves at a whole different pace, more like those of the lakes and ponds. And the impermeable layer of our sandbox often means a hard layer of rock in the real world. which holds the groundwater into literally a pond within the ground, sitting on top of this impermeable layer of rock. And so all this water is available to us underground. It may be harder and more costly to get access depending on how deep it is from you. And never assume that because there is so much in the ground that it'll always be there. You know, I've worked with the engineering department of a rural water district in California, and a majority of those whom we were working with were farmers living, you know, spending their entire lives farming the area. And the area was starting to get dry and dry and dry, and they mostly used or depended upon their groundwater supply through wells to irrigate their crops and for everything else. And we would go into the properties of some farmers about 80 years old saying, you know, we would go with our instruments and measure the groundwater table and tell them, hey, listen, you know, your groundwater dropped 30 feet, you know, in the past couple of years. And they, every single one were, you know, all my time of living, I've never seen this happen. And so being there in California, seeing all of this firsthand, seeing the real effects of the commons groundwater supply literally dwindling under everybody's feet from overconsumption. You will also need to be very sure of what's been exposed to the groundwater too, that you're considering for drinking especially. Even if a dirty industry has been closed for years now around the site, oftentimes it takes 30 plus years for some toxins to reach the groundwater table. And it's not just man-made toxins too you need to pay attention to. You will need to make sure that arsenic, for example, a naturally occurring element within the ground, is at very low and safe levels. Once doubt has been cast aside and you know it's all good, get after it. Drill down a well. But, you may ask, would building a pond be better? Well, let's find out. Place a big open container outside and see if it fills until it overflows. Does this happen? Or is the wind and sun too overcoming? If it fills at all and stays and overflows at times, building a pond will be your winner. Otherwise, head for the shovel, drill, or whatever you got and start digging. But no sweat. Later we can explore non-complicated and cheap ways to drill for water you can do yourself. Building ponds are a winning choice because it's a very cheap way to store a heck of a lot of water. Not only that, but it gives back in a very positive and varied way. Firstly, you're assured water storage for irrigation, livestock watering, and fire safety. You can simultaneously raise fish and create a habitat for birds, other aquatic creatures, and plants. It serves as a recharge zone, diverting runoff from rain slowly into the ground, recharging the groundwater supply. It's also a place to swim and find tranquility. You know, every farm that I've worked on that built themselves a pond also built a sanctuary that became such a pivotal place for my own personal introspection, literally every day. There is something quite spiritual with water that always feels cleansing to me. You can also feel the microclimate it creates too, making it warmer in the winter and a place to cool off in the summer. Now, constructing these babies is a huge undertaking. You will need to pay special attention on where to situate it, design it, and build it. As you think about this, what exactly is it that you're wishing for? Once you know your goals, move ahead and execute. Let's say you move along with your goal of having a living pond. That may also be a place to raise aquaculture and irrigate your tree and crops below. You'll excavate your pond and move the earth around depending on your terrain. And I already plan on taking a whole episode, by the way, to talk about this part of the process of creating earthworks on your site for the purposes of holding water on your site and so on. Once you have it all dug and ready to go, you will place a liner so as to make the floor impermeable so water will stay put. You could do this by tampering clay, whether it's already naturally occurring there in the first place or whether you'll need to bring it in from someplace else. You know, the best, most ideal situation is if you have clay plus pigs. You know, let the pigs wallow and poop and move all around there on top for several days. You know, this will surely seal up the layer. You know, the least ideal though will be to having to bring in a plastic liner, which is extremely expensive. And by doing such, you will also have to lay down sand and gravel to protect the liner from puncturing, from, you know, any sharpness of any kind. Your goal for a living pond is to ensure a level fluctuation of the water surface to range no more than 2 feet, and that it's deep enough to make cool refuge for fish as well. And over time, the complexity and web of relationships among the plants, animals, and insects will increase tremendously. But wait, hold on, wait a minute, you may ask. If you said that ponds recharge the groundwater, how is this so if we are sealing up the pond? Well, depending on your goals and situation, you don't have to seal up the pond, especially if your main limitation is cost and resources. A cheap, beneficial option will be just to make the excavation. This way, you will have a runoff harvesting pond that can fill entirely, but also dry up completely. And the good news is that it's been saved underneath into your groundwater storage. As long as nobody is pumping like a madman nearby, you have your savings account secured. As for the appropriate sizing and evaporation rates and rainfall data and exact calculations, you know, reach out and investigate with your local water resource. If you have trouble in this stage, let me know, because I could also help out. It's what I do for a living. Your depth can range from 5 to 15 feet too, but if you're going to have fish, 15 feet is the deepest you should go, since beyond that can create dead zones that have no oxygen. You know, make sure to include and build in a permanent drain capable of draining the pond in its entirety. Also, a controllable inlet to block off floodwaters, sediment, and unwanted fish. You know, you'll want a fence to block off livestock, and instead maybe provide a watering trough outside the fence for your animals to drink, and this way not contaminate the pond with their stinky poo-poo. Now you may resonate with all of this and agree to push forward with the idea, but you begin to think, I need to make sure I also have a storage of water that I can easily drink from as well. And this line of thinking now brings us to explore the most common way to store water, which is to build an enclosed tank. It is the surest way to have complete control of storage conditions, like security against leaking, protection from mosquitoes and pests, shade and protection from the sun so algae won't grow, and minimal or no evaporation. The design of tanks and its plumbing details take up literally half the book here, and they're very useful, trust me. Like I said, I wish I had this book at hand several years ago when I was scrounging for these answers all compiled within these few pages. It's very do-it-yourself friendly, but don't underestimate the complexity, hard work, and attention to detail that this will require of you. Sometimes the consequences can be severe for any errors you may make, or if you fail to take into consideration, you know, for example, the type of soil underneath the tank uphill, causing it to sink in, break apart, and wiping out anything that stands in its way, which could be your own very house or the entire community. The author here mentions many of his own anecdotal experience around this too, which testifies to these kinds of catastrophes that can happen if you're not careful. So as we begin our thought process of the beginning of the design of our water tank, we have to consider its location, its appropriate size, its shape, its foundation, its roof, the materials to construct it, the cost, regulatory requirements, and, as we said, potential hazards. And no matter the answer to any of these, our tank, regardless, must include the following elements: an inlet for water to come in, an outlet for water to come out, service access for us to come in and maintain, repair, whatever we have to, a drain, an overflow mechanism, critter proofing so you don't come across any unpleasant surprises like a dead mouse or something. You need an air vent, And finally, a provision for sunscreen. Because you know, sunlight plus water equals life, which in this case, with our stored water, would not be a good thing. Once you have algae, then you get something that likes to eat that algae, then that something defecates and so on and so forth. Also, depending on the material you use for the tank, the sun can cause chemical leaching, like with PVC plastic, for example. Never leave PVC plastic exposed to the sun. So when we begin to brainstorm about where to place the tank, we need to consider quite a few factors. You know, how can we place it so that we may get gravity-fed water to where we need it, thereby reducing any unnecessary energy and money into having to pump our water? So say we can get away with gravity-fed pressure. Now the question is, how much pressure? Now remember this and pay very close attention to the following explanations that the author explained very well in the book. And this will give you a great intuitive understanding when trying to imagine the pressure of your water system as it relates to the location of your tank. You know, studying engineering, all my teachers would always say, always ask yourself with every problem you solve, do the numbers make sense? You know, how it's all about getting that intuitive grasp of the numbers you see written down on paper. So with this in particular, he says, pressurized from roof height, you know, having to take on the roof, your appliances will barely work. With your tank, the equivalent of, let's say, 10 stories above you, your washing machine, reverse osmosis water filter, and water heater will start to work. With your storage now 23 stories up, your fire hose will work optimally. But a tank higher than these 23 stories, and things will start to blow up. In other words, 100 PSI should be the maximum pressure of your system. And if you're listening to this from outside the United States, sorry. You know, I know it could be a real hassle going from one measuring system to the next. And while everybody else in the world uses the metric system, I've unfortunately been trained in the other, which is not a problem, just another problem to solve. So back to our 100 PSI as our maximum pressure of our system. You know, this is the ceiling. You could always install a regulator to lower the pressure to whatever value you want, or you can also place another tank, which also acts as a pressure break. And remember, having high pressure could be highly advantageous so as to generate energy via hydroelectric system, as we mentioned earlier. But here are some other optimal values of pressure for the following applications. For example, the optimum pressure for a drip irrigation system is about 25 PSI. For a shower, that's 50 PSI. Same for a washing machine, you know, 50 PSI, dishwasher and all of that. Toilet only needs a minimum of 1 PSI. You know, when I was in Brazil, I remember having to flush, you know, every number two or number one, two, only with a bucket of water, and that was enough, and the thing flushed. So talking about all this pressure and figuring out the best place for our tank, what should be our guideline? Generally, the author says that the lower the pressure, the better. And here's why. It will help you simply to conserve the water you're using. You know, outside the industrialized nations, very low water pressure is the norm. In most houses, you'll see tanks placed on their roofs, although at times this could be very dangerous if attempted to do so as such, you know, placing a tank on your roof that hasn't been particularly engineered, because, you know, a plastic tank, for example, placed on a roof by only, you know, two people, once filled with water, can hold enough weight literally to flatten the house below it. And if you place it away, you need to make sure that it won't sink into the ground or slide down the hill. However, it's safe to say, as a general rule of thumb, that undisturbed native soil is sufficiently strong enough to support a good sized tank. If you think about burying it, just remember too that, you know, what could happen once it's empty. You know, all of a sudden, there will be a great pressure difference from the soils outside pushing from the outside inwards and thus causing the whole thing to cave in and failing. You know, tanks being buried need a special shape. Ideally, you know, the best shape in this case would be egg-like in order to resist these forces in the most efficient manner possible. Also, if buried or even partially buried and the soil becomes wet and saturated, this will cause enough force to literally pop a tank to the surface like a cork. You know, Art Ludwig says for a 1,000 gallon tank, for example, the upward force equals literally 4 tons, and in the right condition, enough to pop up through the asphalt of a driveway and lift a small car. Now, speaking of sizes, what should be our size of the tank? It's all a matter of the degree of water security you want and can afford. Ideally, it will have enough to cover peak demands, or in other words, times of the day when everybody is consuming water and the source that feeds the tank by itself won't be able to do this. You know, like the example I've mentioned earlier, your water source can be barely dripping into your tank at a constant rate and still be able to provide during these peak demands. But you got to calculate it all out, which all starts by measuring and or looking up data. Empowerment is granted once you're able to measure. So let's run through a quick example from the book. We know that our creek nearby will be able to provide us with, you know, 20 gallons per minute, which runs 24/7. We also know how much water we plan to consume at different times of the day, particularly our peak demand being, for this example, 5,200 gallons during 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. Now remember, our creek still only provides us a 20 gallon per minute, of which will put us at a maximum deficit during this time of 1,600 gallons. This number, 1,600 gallons, will be the absolute minimum size of our tank. But ideally, we make it a little bigger because we never know when there might also be a fire during this time, or if something happens to the creek and our supply gets interrupted by any chance. And this is just one of a million examples and considerations of tank design. It's like one of those things where the more you start to think about it, the more you realize how much more thinking you have to do. You know, this is the whole world of engineering. I love it. It's exciting, but the punishment for errors can be unforgiving. Now, I realize I haven't even mentioned the various tank options you could do. Most common nowadays are plastic high-density polyethylene, of which I've installed many in my personal experience. You know, they're quite simple and come in many different sizes. Could even be considered, you know, the most durable tank option, and its mobility makes it highly advantageous. But again, it's plastic, and especially if exposed to the sun, may leach its chemicals into the water supply and thus become a health hazard. The best permanent tank, meaning once you build it, you know, you've built it for life, there's no moving it afterwards, is what is called a ferrosement tank. This is literally as do-it-yourself as it gets, and it can be very cheap. These tanks are essentially constructed from a grid of steel reinforcement covered with a sand cement mix. You know, you could build the wall as thin as a thickness of up to two of your fingers. Now, to ensure that the materials you use aren't going to be toxic, you could verify your cement and your sealers are all NSF 61 certified. Again, that's NSF 61 certified. It takes a while to kind of get these ingrained in your brain. And ferrosement construction is also earthquake resistant, a huge plus, because when such an event usually happens, it takes out everyone's water supply. Now, there are countless other options for tanks, each one having their pros and cons. Like if you wanted to have the absolute cleanest storage for your water, glass would be the way to go, until it breaks at least, and that's its disadvantage. And glass, by the way, has a lower ecological footprint than you may think. Essentially, it's just heated sand. And along these lines, you could also use clay, but which is also quite brittle as well. And for you purists out there, there's always the option to go back to keeping our water stored in animal bladders like the olden times. So, you know, I could keep on going on and on, but I think this might be a good stopping point and end it here for now. The book is physically thin, but it's dense, and dense with the best and most relevant information about water. And I like to have this one handy by my side wherever I go. You know, I can't recommend it enough. So to officially wrap up this summary episode, leave me a comment. What new things did you learn that you haven't heard before? And if you're ready to rock and roll, which strategy and ideas are you going to run with? You know, let me know. Let's build community here, expand our ideas, bounce off from one another, and evolve towards our highest potential together. With that said, until next time.